Welcome. This is William Evans here, and you're listening to a Living World Conversation. This is the second in a series of conversations with Cheryl Page, speaking with us from Clifton, just upstream from Grand Junction. Welcome again, Cheryl.
Thank you, William. I appreciate you having me back.
So, when we were speaking before, we were talking about the potential that exists within us, and you started out by talking about coming to Windstar and wanting to work with John Denver and Tom Crum and Bucky Fuller, and you felt a potential happening there that you have never forgotten and continued to investigate in your way the rest of your life.
Correct.
And tell me who Joe Dispenza is.
So Dr. Joe Dispenza is his official training was as a chiropractor initially, and he had a horrible accident when he was 24 or something like that, where he ruptured his spine. He was hit by a truck in a triathlon. Anyway, he basically was never going to be able to walk again, according to the doctors. And the short of a very long story is he had been researching, spontaneous remissions or spontaneous healings. And he was able to figure out how to heal his ruptured spine and be able to walk again. And so he sort of made a deal with the universe that if you help me figure this out, I will dedicate my life to teaching other people how to heal themselves.
And you've been working with him how long?
Well, I'd say that's an over-exaggeration. I've attended 3 of his week-long meditation retreats, and one of those 3 weeks I had worked as a part of his research team. So at each one of these retreats, they conduct clinical research on whether that's mapping the brain, measuring the blood before and after, taking stool samples, you know, looking at what's happening in the body when you spend 36 hours in meditation with 2,000 people. So they're trying to document more deliberately and thoroughly than anyone has before about the changes that occur in the body as a result of a deep meditative practice, even if you're a neophyte to meditation. I had the opportunity.
This is a big step for an academic researcher from Dartmouth Medical School to have engaged with this and it sounds like you're continuing to learn some new dimension that you were ready for, but you haven't done before.
Well, and if all of a sudden, you know, you're shown something that you would have sworn was not possible, and yet you see with your own eyes that it's possible, then your paradigm has been ruptured, right? And so, but here's the thing, is that we live in a linear culture at a time of nonlinear truth. You know, it's not just left to right. It's not that binary that you and I were talking about before. Truth descends through distortion, and the infinite keeps agreeing to speak through our limited mouths, right? And so to me to bear witness to things that I would have sworn after 24 years in academic medicine that shouldn't be possible, and yet I saw with my own eyes that it was possible, then you have to either go back to sleep or you have to address the rupture in your paradigm and ask more questions. But I think we're entering into a new era of understanding, and the old paradigm and orthodoxy are beginning to shift, and more people are awakening to these other potentials.
Yeah, it's a wild, chaotic time.
Yes, it is.
And so, for me, my personal practice is essential for me to maintain my balance through this kind of experience.
Yeah.
And through injuries and healing and emotional challenges and needing to review something I was taught years ago and finally understand now.
Yeah.
I need the stability of a practice I've developed over my life that works for me. And it's continually evolving.
That's the key piece, right? It's that, but we aren't necessarily, and I don't mean to make, you know, our Western education system the whipping boy here, but our structure, our construct through 12 or, you know, 16 or 24 years of schooling is that we tend to be taught to look in a binary way, true and false.
Yeah, and it's either right or wrong.
Correct. And that's where we then automatically hobble ourselves. If we only are looking for true or false, then we don't have any room for another option. If all we have is the binary, like a light switch is only on and off. But if you install a dimmer switch, you have more play, right? So this is the spiritual dimmer switch.
Well, you use the word hobble. And for our listeners, I'm going to expand on that word. When you ride into a camp on your horse,
yep,
and you climb down from the saddle, you let your animal graze and water, but you don't want him to go back to the place you started from. You want him to stay in camp. And you put a device on his front legs called a hobble, which allows him to move about, take care of his needs in eating and drinking and resting, but he can only take short, small steps, so he's not very far away in the morning when you wake up.
Yep.
And that's a very limiting thing to do to a creature. It's practical and wise and useful for the purposes I described, but when you are unnecessarily hobbled or aggressively hobbled, then your potential is stunted and your future is less joyful and expansive and illuminating.
Well, and if the textbook is, we agree that the textbook has the answers, the true and false, the binary answers, then that is hobbling the human brain from being open to other potentials. And so when my beloved passed, and I was a very Newtonian thinking left brain science girl, I was hobbled, unbeknownst to me, I was hobbled in my thinking, and I was looking for, I didn't have any room for a third option. So the third option I came up with, which at least opened my mind, I could crack the door a little bit, was what if? What if it's real? What if it's not? What if it's true? What if it's false? But what if at least left room for other options to enter my field of awareness, but whereas with a binary, those options, a third option wasn't possible.
Well, and you're in a place where you're entertaining and examining possibilities that you previously might not have considered, because academic researchers don't often get into the kind of meeting and meditation program you're telling me about, but you were ready and you did it.
Yes. And yet, again, back to what Rumi said, it's the wound where the light enters, right? So his passing cracked me open, and through that crack, something else became, you know, more information could leak through.
And it sounds like it, I'm generalizing, but it's a form of life force that leaked through.
Exactly. And yet the beautiful thing is it was there all along, but if something exists as a potential and you're not aware of it, then it doesn't exist as a potential for you. It had been there all along since time immemorial, but I was not open to it because of the binary I was educated with.
Until you woke up.
Until I woke up.
So I want to bring in another thread into this conversation. Okay. And our friend Evan Pritchard, in his lovely little book about the temple within, tells us we cannot honor the old adage, know yourself, until we cultivate a relationship with Source. What can you tell us about your relationship with Source?
Well, it's probably, it's my construct. It doesn't mean it's, again, it's not, the, there's no binary here, but for me, my understanding has shifted. You know, asking about when my beloved passed and this whole idea of continuity of consciousness, even in my Catholic upbringing, if you quote-unquote die and go to heaven, then that implies that some part of you survives death to go to heaven. So, but my Catholic upbringing wasn't broad enough to help me understand, okay, is this idea of continuity of consciousness a real thing? And that was the quest that I embarked upon after he passed. But, you know, for me, it's tricky because in a purely religious construct, the religious construct is a binary as well. And it is not very robust in, it has higher guardrails, I guess I want to say. And so my Catholic upbringing gave me a very different idea of what Source was as a someone, but Source being a noun versus, like, Buckminster Fuller wrote a book called I Seem to Be a Verb.
Right.
And I think that for me, Source is now more of a verb than a noun.
Evan follows what he said initially about Source with reference to Lao Tzu, telling us that if we do not realize the source, we will stumble in confusion and sorrow. When we realize where we come from, we naturally become tolerant, disinterested, amused, kind-hearted as a grandmother, and dignified as a king.
Yes. And for me, that if source is a verb, then it has motion. Like if you go back to Aramaic, in the language of Aramaic, the language that Christ spoke during his time on earth, those nomadic people didn't have a word for to be. They only spoke in terms of becoming. A fruit was never ripe, it was always ripening. And so because they were constantly in motion, their language portrayed the fact that they were constantly in motion. And so to me, to say I am is like to be, right? And I am stops the motion. And in my lived experience at this point on my journey, source isn't always in motion. I don't know if I can go all the way to say that source is the quantum field, the infinite field of all potential. But if you look at, you know, they've proven that the Casimir effect exists. The Casimir effect is the scientific proof that this space in front of each of us is not empty but full. And it is full of oscillating little plonk packets of potential. the next question is, how much energetic potential is in a sugar cube of space? And the answer is 10 to the 93rd grams per centimeter cube. That's 10 comma 93 zeros. A trillion has 12 zeros, and we're talking 93 zeros of energetic potential to infinity. So the point is, I think that source for me as a someone was a very hobbled vantage point. That doesn't pass judgment on anybody else who finds value in that perspective. But for me, source as a verb points, again, don't confuse the moon with the finger pointing towards it, but I feel like that it is pointing to a more broader understanding, not of just what source is, because I'm not separate from source. I am a part of that. I am a cell in the body of God, if you will. I'm one of those little oscillating packets of potential. So source is in motion, and if I am a cell in the body of source, then I am in motion as well. So I think Bucky was right. We seem to be verbs.
This is KDNK, and you're listening to A Living World Conversation with Cheryl Page. Well, I'm a child of source.
Okay.
And for me, being is a very lovely option. I spent a lot of time when I was young doing.
Yeah.
And then got into having. I have lots of stuff I still have to sort through. But being is a totally different state that's absolutely a blessing, because I may not need to do anything or have anything more than what I have, and that begins to present the opportunity I may have enough, and I can be at peace in that state of being.
Yes, and so as I've been working with myself on the way, if words cast spells, we spell words and words cast spells, then I am not, right this minute, I am being, which is in motion, not be as in stillness. Even when I'm still, I'm in motion. So there's this value in understanding that I am being rather than to be. Because nothing really is just, even a rock has some form of consciousness and is more than just be, but instead it is being. And so I think there's value in the understanding. I agree with you completely that being is more meaningful to me at this point in my life than doing or having, but it's still in motion. That being, if I'm sitting in meditation, I am being in communion with source. It's still a verb, is an action word, right?
Yes, and we began our conversation with a keto. And you've, I think, probably done much more keto than I have. But I would venture to say that in a keto, in skiing powder, there were times where I was more being than doing. The movements I was making were very small, but very critical and precise and loving.
Yeah.
And I was in harmony with the world around me.
Yes.
Do you still experience that?
Far more than I ever did prior to July of 2017, yes. Because, again, it's like if I am a master carpenter and all I have is a hammer and a nail and a saw, then I only have the capacity of those tools. And once I've used the nail, I don't have access to that anymore. And so whatever I can do with the hammer and the saw are limited, but because I don't have more tools. And so I would say on my journey from July of 2017 to now, I have acquired many more tools. And so my journey is far more robust, and what I can build and construct internally and around me is far more robust because I have more tools. And so the tools matter to what it is that we are capable of experiencing.
Say more.
Well, you know, essentially, I think that, you know, who was it? Is it Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, maybe? But whoever said it, you know, we're, maybe it was Ram Dass. We're all just walking each other home, right? We're on a journey back to the place that we all came from. And there's this dimensional dissonance, if you will, between the old paradigm of cognition and emergent perceptual intelligence. There is so much more potential. And yet I think that if you and I were alive in, you know, 1592, we would have an awareness of what was potential, what was real and what was true based on our environment and the tools and the awareness we have. And then you fast forward to 1892 and 1992 and 2025. Each one of those stops along that linear line of human history has different information that wasn't available to previous generations. And if we're all walking each other home, you know, my emergence isn't built. It's invited. The pattern longs for itself, right? So I am in, like a flower doesn't have to do anything. It doesn't have to try to bloom. But I think that we have, as sort of spiritual seekers, if you will, we have to be willing to step, at least in my lived experience, we have to step outside the walls of logic. We have to have the courage to not know. There's potential in not knowing that doesn't any longer exist once we know. So I'm trying very hard to go from question to question rather than from question to answer.
Well, and I, for me, there's an extension of what you're saying, and that is that I can go sit by the river and just listen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a state of being and harmony that I've come to value and be nourished by that allows me to realize much of what I did was excessive and unnecessary.
Yeah.
And so I have a whole new relationship with how much is enough, and it's qualitative in proportion to my waking up and being able to listen.
Yeah, well, I say to people all the time, if you want quantum answers, you have to ask quantum questions. So a Newtonian question seeks certainty and assumes separation. There's a cause and effect. It's a fixed state to be, perhaps, instead of being. But quantum questions seek relationship. They don't collapse the waveform. They don't collapse the mystery. They activate it instead. So we evolve as we engage with the mystery. What happens to me when I engage is more robust if I'm in the river. If I know the answer, I've docked my boat and I've stopped. I've taken myself back to your point about the flow. Questions keep us in the river. Questions keep us in the flow. But we have been trained to only seek answers and binary answers at that. And so if I go from question to question, then I keep myself in the river. I can dock my boat for a minute. But if I want to stay in the river, if I want to dwell in that fertile, unnameable space where wonder lives, and waves are not collapsed, where the mystery still has room to move, that's what's exciting to me.
Well, and the mystery may involve transformation and be transformation.
Yes, but it's the byproduct, though. It's the derivative of, do you know what I mean? So it's, we would get that anyway. If we go into the apple orchard and the apples are on the tree, all we have to do is the byproduct. The apples are already there. All we have to do is pick them. So that evolution will happen if we stay in the flow, as you said, well, if we stay in the river.
Well, and the river is evaporating, condensing, coming down out of the snow and the rain. And it's a metaphor for the circle of possibilities and potentials that we haven't seen, but that are continually being renewed in the water cycle.
Exactly. And water is the perfect example because, you know, you hear this conversation about water having memory, but water isn't fixed storage. It's dynamic pattern retention. So water doesn't hold memory like a hard drive. Instead, it holds patterns of coherence that emerge and dissolve, like you just said. So I think about it as a vibrational imprinting rather than a literal archiving.
Yeah, I think that's a good point because we think of bigger hard drives all the time.
And that's binary, right? Here it is. I'm going to put it on the hard drive.
Yep.
As opposed to flow dynamics, which is the truth about water.
Wow. This has been wonderful. Thank you, Cheryl.
I appreciate you.
This is KDNK, and you've been listening to A Living World Conversation with Cheryl Page. Thank you for listening. Well, those are going to be fun to edit.
There you go, brother.